Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today, we're taking a look into the world of Kurdish literature. We'll be exploring its journey, drawing on historical accounts and scholarly work to really grasp its lasting importance.
Yeah, we've got a good range of sources, looking at everything from those really old oral traditions right up to modern novels.
Exactly. And our aim is, well, to uncover how literature works to keep Kurdish identity alive, especially considering the fragmented homeland and the large diaspora.
It's a huge task for any literature, but maybe even more so in the Kurdish context.
We'll be examining, you know, how the oral and written forms interact, how themes and styles have changed over time.
And the impact of politics, definitely. Plus, trying to highlight the many different voices that make up this literary heritage, which often doesn't get the attention it deserves.
Absolutely. It feels like the logical starting point is that powerful oral tradition, with the Dengbej right at the heart of it.
For sure. These figures, the Dengbej, the name itself means teller through voice. They were absolutely crucial as the keepers of Kurdish memory and history.
They weren't just entertainers, were they? It sounds much deeper than that.
Oh, much deeper. They performed stram, these long narrative songs and epics, often without any instruments, which is interesting.
Really? No instrument?
Mostly, yeah. It allowed for more improvisation, a very direct kind of storytelling. And their range was incredible. Love, war, heroes, local history, feuds, rebellions.
Wow.
And even mourning songs, the laje. Becoming a master Dengbej took years. Intense memorization, but also developing those vital improvisational skills.
They were adapting stories, too.
Exactly. We're talking about living libraries here, especially when you think about the general lack of state institutions or widespread literacy, historically.
And this oral way of passing things down, it proved pretty resilient against efforts to, well, assimilate Kurdish culture, didn't it?
Extremely resilient. It was a core part of cultural survival.
Yeah.
And it's significant that there are efforts now to revive the tradition, like setting up Mala Dengbejian houses of Dengbej in cities like Amed.
That makes sense. And this powerful oral base, it directly feeds into the written literature that follows, right?
Absolutely. It's not a clean break. Take the famous epic Memuzin.
Amedizani's work.
Yes, but it existed in oral form first, as Memealain. Zani wrote it down and expanded on it in the 17th century, but its roots are clearly oral.
So there's this ongoing conversation between the two forms.
Definitely, and it continues. You see modern writers like Mehmet Uzun or Mehmet Dikel consciously drawing on folklore and that Dengbej legacy. It grounds their work.
Okay, so let's talk about the written side. Pinpointing the absolute start seems a bit tricky based on the sources.
It is. There are theories connecting Kurdish to very ancient texts like the Avesta, mentions of old documents, but, yeah. Well, finding concrete proof is hard.
But the earliest verifiable text we have is what?
It's a Christian prayer, actually, from the 15th century, written in Kurmanji but using Armenian letters, dated somewhere between 1430 and 1446.
That's quite specific and quite early, really. What does that tell us?
Well, it shows written Kurdish existed, even if maybe sporadically, and using another script. And being a religious text suggests one early motivation was making religious material accessible.
Right. But more substantial, continuous literature comes later.
Yes, really from the 16th century onwards. Though we do have earlier names popping up.
Like Baba Tahir Hamadani, around the 11th century with his quatrains.
Him, yes. And maybe Balul even earlier, 9th century, a Guarani poet linked to the Yarsani faith. And Ali Hariri, another early Kurmanji poet, around the 11th century too.
It's interesting that we see activity in different dialects, Guarani, Kurmanji, quite early on.
It really reflects the linguistic reality of the Kurds. You know, the diversity and the geographic spread, the fragmentation. Guarani was actually a very important early literary language, especially for religious texts and in places like the Ardalan Emirate.
So the linguistic landscape was complex from the start.
Pretty much, yeah. Which sets the stage for how things develop later.
Okay, moving into what's often called the classical period, roughly 16th and 19th centuries, Kurmanji seems to come to the fore first, then Sarani later.
That's the general pattern. Classical Kurmanji literature, say 16th to 18th century, really blossomed under the Kurdish emirates.
And they adopted literary forms from the wider Islamic world, like Diwan, Qasida, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Forms like the Diwan, poetry collections, Qasida, odes, Ghazal, love poems, and Mathnawi, rhyming couplets, often narrative. It shows Kurdish poets were part of that broader cultural conversation.
And who are the key figures in this Kurmanji phase?
Well, Malay Ciziri is huge. around 1570 to 1640, often seen as the founder of that classical Kurmanji school. His Diwan is full of really sophisticated, mystical Sufi poetry.
He showed what Kurmanji could do within those established forms.
Precisely. Then there's Fakih-e Tehran, but later, 1590 to 1660, he was known for narrative poems, the Mathnawi.
Like Hikayat the Sexy Sinan.
That's one, yes. But significantly, he also wrote the earliest known literary account of the Battle of Dimdim.
Ah, so moving beyond just religious themes.
Definitely. It's historical narrative touching on themes of resistance even then. We also have Mela Hussaini Baitai later, maybe late 17th to mid-18th century. His Muluda Kurmanji, celebrating the prophet's birth, became incredibly popular, even crossing into oral traditions of other groups.
But the name that really stands out from this era is Emadeh Zani.
Oh, absolutely. 1650 to 1707, a towering figure. And his epic, Memuzin, finished in 1692. It's just fundamental.
Based on that oral Meme Allen story we mentioned, why is it considered the Kurdish national epic? It's more than just a love story, right?
Much more. Yes, it's a powerful, tragic romance. But the political subtext is impossible to ignore, especially in the preface.
What does he say there?
Zinet explicitly writes about Kurdish disunity, about being ruled by Ottomans and Safavids. He clearly expresses a longing for Kurdish unity, for a Kurdish ruler, for sovereignty. It's remarkably direct.
And setting the story start on Newroz, the Kurdish New Year, that adds another layer, doesn't it?
A massive layer of national symbolism. It connects the story intrinsically to Kurdish identity and aspirations.
Yeah. And Zani did other things, too. A dictionary.
Yes. Nubi Harabis Sukan, an Arabic-Kurdish dictionary for children. And a religious poem, Eki Deya Imani. He was committed to developing the language on multiple fronts.
His choice to write his masterpiece in Kurmanji, not Persian or Arabic, feels like a statement in itself.
A huge statement. A conscious act of cultural affirmation. He knew the literary traditions he built on his predecessors, but he used his talent specifically to articulate this emerging Kurdish national consciousness. Its status today confirms its impact.
Okay, so while all this is happening in Kurmanji, Sorani written literature starts gaining more ground a bit later, late 18th, early 19th century. Is there a reason for that timing?
The sources suggest a link to the rise of cultural hubs, particularly Sulaymaniye, which was founded in 1784.
How would a city like that help?
Well, you get potential patronage from rulers, you get intellectual circles forming, poets meeting, sharing work, maybe schools favoring Sorani. It creates an environment where literature can flourish.
And Nali is the key name here.
Nali, yes. 1798 to 1855. He's credited with compiling the first complete Dewan in Sorani. That's a major milestone.
Establishing Sorani as a major literary player.
Exactly. His work, and that of contemporaries like Salim and Kurdi, really built the foundations for the Sorani literary tradition.
And later in the 19th century, figures like Haji Kadir Khori, Sheikh Reza Talabani,
Mawi Wafai too. Their work often starts to engage more directly with themes of cultural revival, identity, resistance against outside pressures.
So a growing political awareness coming through in the poetry.
You see that more and more. Calls for preserving the language, for cultural awakening, hints of autonomy. It reflects that shift towards a more modern nationalist sentiment.
It's fascinating how the prominence seems to shift Gurani early on, then Kurmanji's classical period, then the rise of Sorani. It mirrors the changing dynamics within Kurdistan itself.
It really does map onto those shifts in regional power and cultural centers over time.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady's here? Roj Bosh Hannah? Oh, this smells absolutely divine today. It's got that rich, spicy aroma. Definitely extra cardamom.
Hmm, lovely.
You know, sometimes her chai can be a little bitter if she's had a busy morning, needs a bit more sugar. But today it's perfect. That ideal balance of sweetness and spice. Let's just take a moment to enjoy this.
Sips chai. Ah, yes. She has truly excelled today. A welcome pause. Definitely not bitter today.
Sips chai. Perfect. Okay, thoroughly refreshed by Hannah's wonderful chai, let's get back to it. We were just talking about the rise of Sorani literature in the 19th century.
Right, and that leads us into the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a period of significant modernization. Yeah. New themes, new forms, closely linked with the rise of Kurdish nationalism.
And Haji Kadir Khoi, whom we mentioned as a Sorani poet, seems like a bridge figure here.
He really is. While still using some classical forms, he drastically broadened the subject matter. He wrote about modern national life, the need for education, the importance of Kurdish.
Moving away from the purely religious or mystical focus.
Considerably, yes. He was engaging with ideas of self-determination in a way that felt quite new.
Then there's Abdurrahim Armi Zapsu, early 20th century. He focused on contemporary issues and used more spoken Kurdish.
Yes, trying to make the literature more grounded in contemporary life, more accessible, perhaps.
But the really pivotal figure for modern poetry seems to be Abdul Goran.
Absolutely. Goran, 1904 to 1962, he's often called the father of modern Kurdish poetry, especially in Sorani. He made a much more radical break.
How so?
He pioneered free versirinwe and prose poems, moved away from strict classical meters and rhymes, explored nature, love, social critique, the political situation, using folklore, but with totally modern feel.
What drove this wave of modernization? It wasn't just Goram, presumably.
No, several things came together. The rise of Kurdish journalism was huge.
Like the newspaper Kurdistan.
Yes, started in Cairo, then others like Jin and Istanbul, and importantly, Hawar in Syria later on. These provided platforms for new writing and ideas.
And education.
The spread of secular education broadened horizons, created more readers interested in modern issues. Plus, there was increased exposure to Western literature, romanticism, realism offering new models.
So all these things, newspapers, schools, outside influences, pushed Kurdish literature in new directions.
They were definitely catalysts. Poetry forms diversified, themes expanded, nationalism, resistance, cultural revival became central, social critique, individual identity, the connection to the land, all became much more prominent.
Some scholars even talk about phases, right? Like a renewal period, a renaissance, moving beyond the classical era.
Yes, terms like nada, renaissance, are used. It helps track the shifts, though you have to be careful not simply mapping European timelines onto it, but it shows a real sense of transformation.
Now, inevitably, the 20th and 21st centuries bring huge challenges. Statelessness, the division of Kurdistan after World War I, that must have profoundly shaped the literature.
Profoundly. That division into parts of Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria meant literature started developing on somewhat separate tracks in each state.
And statelessness itself becomes a major theme.
Oh, absolutely central. You see it constantly, writers grappling with what homeland means when it's divided, dealing with displacement, nostalgia, alienation, especially in novels.
And on top of division, there was active suppression of the language and literature.
Yes, very harsh suppression at times. Outright bans on the Kurdish language in Turkey for decades, from 1925 right up to 1991 in many contexts. Restrictions in Syria, Iran, Iraq had fluctuating periods, sometimes more tolerant, sometimes intense crackdowns.
So just writing in Kurdish or tackling Kurdish themes could be dangerous.
Extremely dangerous. Writers face censorship, jail, exile. People like Mehmet Uzun, Jalal Bardanji, Shirin Kuami, their life stories reflect these risks.
Mm-hmm.
Publishing in Kurdish became in itself an act of resistance.
And then there's the issue of different alphabets.
Right. Another layer of complexity. You have the Latin-based Hawar alphabet, developed mainly for Kurmanji in the 1930s by Saladet Bedirksen.
The one used widely in Turkey and Syria now.
Yes. But then Sorani uses an Arabic-based script adapted for Kurdish sounds. And historically, Cyrillic was used in the Soviet Union, and we saw the Armenian script used early on.
That must make it harder for Kurds to read literature from different regions.
It definitely creates barriers. It hinders a unified literary conversation across dialects. Standardization efforts pop up, but they often get tangled in politics.
Despite all these challenges, the Kurdish novel really starts to take off from the mid-20th century.
Yes, it becomes a major form. Mehmet Uzun, whom we mentioned facing exile, is credited with really revising the Kurmanji novel. His works like Two explore identity and exile so powerfully.
And in Sorani.
Bekir Ali is a huge name, born in 1960. He uses magical realism, often, to explore the complexities of Kurdish society, especially after conflict. Novels like The Last Pomegranate of the World or Death of a Second Only Child have gained international attention.
Magical realism, that's interesting, allows for exploring trauma and absurdity.
Perhaps, yes. It offers different ways to process difficult realities. And there are other notable novelists, too. Jan Dost, Selahattin Demirtas, who wrote from prison.
And Behruz Bukhani, whose book No Friend But the Mountains was famously written via text messages from detention.
An extraordinary example, yes. We also see the Bildungsroman, the coming-of-age story, being used effectively to explore how Kurdish identity is formed under pressure.
And those core themes of resistance and exile, they obviously continue in contemporary work.
Very much so. Think of the poet Sherko Bekas, who passed away in 2013. He was revolutionary in Sorani poetry, leading the Rouange movement, writing about freedom, struggle, the Anfal genocide. Powerful, often harrowing work.
And Jalal Barzanji, also facing imprisonment and exile for his writing.
His story is emblematic. And the literature coming out of the diaspora is full of that complex negotiation of identity, memory, alienation, the pull of the homeland.
But it's not only about politics and struggle anymore, is it? The sources suggest themes are broadening.
That's true. Contemporary writers are increasingly exploring urbanization, individual psychology, philosophy, even environmental concerns. There's stylistic experimentation, too. Political fiction, yes. But also that magical realism, more experimental structures.
It suggests a literature that's maturing, engaging with a wider world.
Exactly. While the political context is often inescapable, there's a move to explore the full spectrum of human experience, but through a distinct Kurdish lens.
And crucially, women writers are becoming much more visible.
Yes, and that's incredibly important. They're challenging patriarchy within Kurdish society itself, tackling issues like women's rights, social injustice, violence against women, exploring female identity in ways that were perhaps less common before.
Names like Semil Shahin, Sarah Omar come up.
Yes, Shahin's novel Commando Ajax mixes genres exploring displacement. Sarah Omar has gained attention for tackling very sensitive issues facing women. Their voices add essential perspectives and internal critiques.
And finally, that diaspora literature we touched on, it seems to have its own distinct character now.
It does. It's grappling with what it means to be Kurdish when you're living in Sweden or Germany or Canada. How do you maintain the language?
Yeah.
How does statelessness feel from afar? How does identity evolve across generations in a new place? It's a really dynamic part of the picture.
So as we wrap this up, it feels clear that Kurdish literature is so much more than just books. It's like a living archive, isn't it?
Absolutely. A dynamic expression of identity and just a testament to incredible resilience in the face of huge challenges, political, cultural, everything.
From those ancient Dengbej carrying history in their voices, right through to today's novelists and poets grappling with modern complexities, it's this thread connecting people across time and borders.
And its evolution is fascinating. They're back and forth with the oral tradition, adapting to different scripts, responding constantly to political pressure, embracing new forms. It really shows how a culture can keep going, even thrive under difficult circumstances.
Yeah. A growing role of women writers, the voices from the diaspora, they just keep adding richness to it all. Of course, the challenges aren't gone. Linguistic fragmentation is still real. Political uncertainty continues.
True. Those are ongoing issues. But the spirit that comes through in the literature, that commitment to memory, to identity, to connection, it feels incredibly strong.
It really suggests a future where this creativity and resilience will continue. We definitely encourage you, the listener, to seek out translations or learn more about these writers.
There's so much insight there.
Thinking back on our conversation, what aspect of this literary history stands out most to you? And maybe for you listening, what further questions does this raise about that intricate dance between literature, identity, and political life?